Again, I am Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. Is it plain that a life that includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness? Is that plain to me? I would like to say it's plain to me, except for the fact that I tend to still, well, I don't have deep resentments, but I'll still lean that way every now and then. To the extent we permit these, we squander the offers that might have been worthwhile. So we returned to the list again. So we talked about this list. And we didn't go through a lot of mechanics, and I'm still not going to go through it. Who in here has never done an inventory? Who's never done a resentment inventory? So we got veterans in here. Oh, one person has admitted not doing a resentment inventory. So we're going to triple that number at least. So it's at least three people who haven't done a resentment inventory. Thanks for being a representative for those who haven't done one. And so in inventory, you know, there are some questions. And so I'm just going to go through really fast, really fast. And some people have only done, you know, probably who's only done one inventory, a first inventory. And so that's the inventory of the gross or handicaps. Some of the common questions that come up, I remember when I was first doing an inventory, and I'd ask, how many inventories should I write? And again, that's individual. There are people who say you should only write one inventory from that point forward. You should be involved in the process of 10 and 11. And there are other people who say you should write inventory annually. There are other people. So I used to have firm ideas when it came to inventory. I used to have some ideas like never put yourself on inventory, had opinions about whether God should go on an inventory. I don't have any ideas and any opinions at all now. I don't see, I never see any bad that comes out of writing, and I don't see any bad that comes out of looking. And there are those back in my earlier days, and when you first get on this path, really about how to do this thing right. You know, I've seen checklists, I've seen 16 columns, I've seen 4 columns, which is the book, I've seen 5 columns, I've seen all manner of inventory, you know. And again, I don't have an opinion. What Charlie and I have been sharing today is what we do, individually, what it is that we do. And I don't see a bad way to look. And I've changed a lot in that. So now, that being said, I've written a lot of inventories. And I've even come to change my mind a little on that, but not really that much. I've written a lot of inventories. In 1987, my brother and my friend and I were at a meeting with some people, and they presented the big book in a way I had never seen before. I was a year sober. And this was a group out of Santa Monica called the Big Book by the Sea. And Charlie mentioned one of the guys who was facilitating that workshop, Joe Hawk, and they came and they presented the big book in a way I had never seen before. These people did. And so my brother and I asked two of the members would they do the same thing with us. And in November of 87, about 12 of us sat around my mother's dining room table on a Sunday morning, and we started going through the book page by page, line by line. And that took us about a year, and we only went through chapter 7. When it said do a prayer, we did a prayer. When it said write, we wrote as a group. We did the third step, the seventh step prayer on our knees, and the experience was transformative. And some people heard about it, and we do what we do when we like something. We do it again. And some people had heard about it and said, we'd like to do that, and we're not exclusive. So we opened my mother's door up again, and some more people came. And we did it again, and some more people heard about it, and we opened her door up again. And in about 5 years, we outgrew my mom's house. And tomorrow morning, the Never Too Early Big Book Workshop will be meeting again on Sunday morning. And Tamisha's here. She's from our group. And we have about 250 people now that meet on Sunday mornings, going through the book page by page and line by line. And that's an experience that I wasn't anticipating when we first opened those doors. You know, I didn't know. And people come now and people say, Charlie mentioned it earlier about going to meetings. Tarek and I think were talking, and he said his brother asked him, do you still go to those meetings? And if you're new, or fairly new, and if you start going and people start asking, people say, why do you guys still have that workshop? Why do you still go there every Sunday morning? And my simplest answer is, my mom's been going to Bible study for almost all of her 89 years, and she still goes. People ask, why do you still go to those meetings? And same answer. My mom still goes to church every Sunday morning. Many church-going people, you would never, they'd never be, I mean, they'd be extremely offended if you say, why do you still go to church? I still go to meetings. This is my spiritual, this is my cathedral. And many of our members choose to go back to church and the rest of that. And I get something different, but this is what I do. This is where I get spiritually fed. So as a group, as a result of that, every year as a group, we take steps together as a group. So I do inventory as a member of that group every year. Now, it's been a long time since I've had more than three names on a resentment inventory. It's been a long time, because if you live in this way of life, something should get different. Now, I have a lot of members that, you know, well-meaning try to, you know, do the false humility. You know, shit, I'm still not that spiritual. I'm 33 years sober, and I'm still not. Well, I should look different. If this deal is really working, I should look different. I shouldn't be as quick to get resentments. I should be able to process them quickly. And I can tell you now, as a result of training your feet, and what we're really talking about is foot training your feet. It sounds like a mental exercise that we talk about, and don't fall for it. Don't bite. Don't bite. Don't get caught up in that exercise, the mental gymnastics of it. There are some things that it's good to get into that frame. The reason why now, as a result of doing inventory so much, I go from one to four like that. I go from one to four like that. And I don't go to one to four like that because I've only done one. I go to one to four like that because it's a way of life. Just like I used to go 0 to 60 in anger because it was a way of life. I used to go 0 to, you know, I used to be able to sit up, you know, roll a J, just light it up. I mean, just like that. Now, this new way of life has been something that's been ingrained in me. And so I can go from one to four. So how many times that you should you write? I don't know. That's going to be something for each individual to determine for themselves. As we go through the rest of these steps, when you get to the back end, you'll be better able. I'm the kind of guy, I'm messy and I'm sloppy. So I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit. But one of the reasons I've always done regular inventory is because I don't wash the dishes every night. I don't make up the bed every day. I don't sweep under the bed. I don't. What I mean by that is I don't do that kind of house cleaning in 10 and 11 every night. So for me, at the end of some period of time, it's good for me to take a look. My mom used to call that spring cleaning. Yeah, she kept a night. My mom kept a clean house, but spring cleaning was different. Now we go get the windows. I didn't like it. It wasn't spring cleaning. It was summer when we were supposed to be out of school. Go get the, you know, we're doing walls and we're doing. That's what inventory soon started representing. So that was the deal. How many people should be on my first inventory? Oh, I don't know. The worst thing you can do if you haven't done inventory before, or even if you have done an early inventory, is compare yourself next to your boy's inventory. Man, you only got 13 names? I had 313 names. Oh, shit. What's wrong with me, you know? I don't know. Again, that's a matter for you and your sponsor. The thing, though, in the book, what it talks about, the only thing that counts is thoroughness and honesty. Well, what does that mean? And people will look back and say, I wasn't thorough in my first inventory. I think I was as thorough as I could be with everything I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got this kind of conceit that makes me think I could have done more than I could have when I'm, because I'll listen to Charlie sit up at the front and I'll be a big, I want to be a big boy before I'm a big boy. Be where you are. You know what I'm saying? And so the effort, God is going to smile on the effort, not on the result. You know, don't trip off that. Don't beat yourself up about that. Don't try to get an A in AA. You know, I didn't, I stopped an inventory one time. Now I'm just streaming, sharing about my experiences with this fourth step. One of my worst experiences is with the fourth step. I had one time where I didn't complete an inventory. Guess why? Because I started writing. It was about my second or third inventory. And I started writing. And you have to have done one to know what I'm getting ready to talk about. And I started, and I put my first column, I started writing names. And then in my second column, I started writing causes. And I did too many names and causes on a couple of sheets. And when I did my third column, when I do third column, I do what we call extended third column, and I write sentences on each one of the resentments. And my third column ran into the next name. And then the next third column ran into the next. And I was like, and I didn't like the way that I had my papers formatted. And I didn't want to start over again and quit. Didn't do inventory for something that cosmetic. But that those kind of experiences have been invaluable to me. You know, those kind of experiences have been, I'm a falling down, making mistakes, making messes, guys. So those are the kind of people I attract. And I'm able to already foresee that when it's coming. You know, stupid stuff like that is what will trip me up in inventory. You know, and I've been tripped up in inventory for something like that. Not the substance of it, you know. One of the things that also helped me in inventory that I learned when I was new, the difference with you guys that's up in here, you're a different kind of audience. We're really singing to the choir to people who come to an event like this. You know, we really are singing to the people that's already in the game. I like it. I like talking to the players. I kind of like it, though, when I'm talking to the people that's on the sidelines. I don't mind talking to the haters, and I don't mind, like, you know, I kind of like that, too. I like making it interesting and making it attractive, making it available. So I know that kind of deal. So how often should I write inventory? How many names should I have on inventory? Should somebody keep showing up on your inventory? Well, that's an interesting thing. And again, inventory is personal. It is very, it's a very personal deal. My old man showed up three times, you know. My old man showed up three times. Each time I saw something different with him. Now, if somebody is showing up and you're 15 years sober and somebody keeps showing up on every inventory that you write, like I said, it's probably not a fourth step. It's not something else you need to see. It's something else you probably need to do. And Charlie and I haven't got to those steps yet, but it's probably something else I need to do. And a lot of times I can get caught up in that treadmill of thinking that there are some steps that are the most important. Everything I do, I go back to four. Everything I do, I go back to writing. There was a time when I thought that was the panacea for every, no matter what it is. A guy comes to me, man, Ralph, I'm stepping out on my old lady. I'm married. I want to stay married. Let's write about that. Let's do a sex inventory on that. That would be my knee-jerk reaction, you know. Let's write about it. Let's write about it. Let's write about it. We write about it, we write about it, we write about it. Damn, Spence, I did it again. I'm stepping out on my lady, and now I'm previewing. We'll get to some other steps, you know. So I don't know. Sometimes, you know, you write until, and again, Ralph, then why do you keep saying this stuff if you keep saying it? Because there are no mechanical answers to spiritual condition. There are mechanical means of looking, but there ain't no cookie-cutter answer to people. We're people. We're people. And all you guys are sitting out there sponsoring, remember, this is people. Not robots and not automatons and not, oh, you give so-and-so the same answer and now you know, this is people. You know, and so that's the, and so we turn back to the list, it's clear to the, and putting out the mind of the wrongs others had done us, we looked at our own mistakes. where we've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. Then it talks about, and I'm not going to touch it, but very briefly, I touched it briefly before. Charlie, I know, is going to go a lot into that prayer that we do. Perhaps the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Now, I've got a friend that thinks that that prayer should be said for everybody on your resentment list. I differ. Okay, I differ. It shouldn't be done for everybody that showed up on my resentment list. Maybe it should be done for everybody that shows up on your resentment list. Why shouldn't that prayer be for everybody that shows up on your resentment list, Ralph? Because that says this. This was our course. We realized people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Check this out. Everybody on my inventory list was not somebody who wronged me. My grandmother was on my inventory list. She made the mistake of being in my life. My grandmother was on my inventory list. She was fat. She dipped snuff. She embarrassed me. Does that sound like a lady who was spiritually sick? Sound like a man who was. That's the guy you're looking at. You don't have to wrong me to end up on my resentment list. So when I read that one, I'm one that says, when you read this, apply it to the situation. So my grandmother did not, that prayer didn't apply to my grandmother. Both my grandmothers ended up on my resentment list. And they only made the mistake of being in Ralph White's life. So that's where we applied that prayer to. So we have two other inventories that we do. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way, putting on our minds that the list of wrongs others have done us, where we've been selfish. Okay, we place them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly. Notice the word fear is bracketed alongside. So then that's the second inventory. And I'm assuming that everybody did inventory, did resentment inventory. Has everybody done a fear inventory? Fear inventory. I'm going to talk very briefly about fear inventory in my own experience. And fear inventory, I've been having the hardest time lately. I've been having the hardest time lately sharing at times at events like this. Because I'm moving. And in some places, I'm not sure where I'm ending up. And in some places, I think I do a disservice to share where I'm moving. And not give people the benefit of being and allowing people to have the experience there. When I move, I just want to discount all the experiences I had. Don't want to talk about them, don't want to share them no more. I want to share where I am right now. Oh, but the journey to get to where I am right now was so rich. That I gotta stay and I gotta share it. Because I robbed people of that experience that I had. And then when I got on my knees, I said, take away my difficulty, the victory over them, may bear witness to those I would help, but I power, I love, and that way of life. And I just wanna be where I am right now. I wanna share where I am right now, like my sponsor shares with me. But I haven't always been where I am right now. It's a challenge. Me and Leslie talk about that from time to time. And it is a challenge, and I'm talking to myself right now. So let me get back to talking to you guys and go through fear inventory. Because there's some stuff that I think about right now that is like, oh, my God. But, Charlie, it's the journey. You know what I'm saying? It's the journey. You know, and I'm not... I look back on young me. Some of the things that were so important to me. And how excited I would get. Charlie talked about, he read the Cornerstone when he was doing one of the readings. And back when I first got introduced to this, when we talked about the Cornerstone, that would lead us to talk about all of the stones. And I would get so excited about the metaphors, and I get so excited about the spiritual arch, and I get so excited about those. And I like seeing other people get excited too. So let me share shit that I'm still excited about. You know what I'm excited about? I'm still excited to be in front of you guys sharing this journey with you. And this part right here, this used to be my favorite step to share on 4 and 5, you know, and I'm excited. That man right there. He lights me up. Because I don't get to do and the be and the see myself the way I was. And part of the reason why I'm an old man. And I sometimes look at Tarik and I'm so grateful that I get to share some stuff. And hopefully, fellas, you don't have to be old before some of this stuff comes into play. Fear inventory and sex inventory. And now about sex. I'm going to talk about fear and I'm going to talk about sex together. So this idea of sex, how many people sponsor? What's the number one agenda on the item most of the time when you're talking to sponsors? Him or her, right? Relationships, relationship problems, and the rest. Now about sex. We wouldn't be human if we didn't have problems in those areas, you know. And I get the opportunity to share with guys, and now I'm on a whole different tip. We're going to talk about it, and what I really like talking about now is 6 and 7. I like talking about, and I can't wait till we start talking about those, because I see so much stuff in a different way. And one of the things I see differently is this whole sex inventory area. Now there are 9 questions in the sex inventory. You know, the first 8 questions go to my past conduct, the 9th question goes to my future conduct, and a guide to my future conduct. And when I wrote sex conduct inventory, and when I first approached sex inventory, I thought it was going to be something like a spiritual Kama Sutra. Let's talk about, you know, the sex positions and all of the girls you've been with and all that. And it ain't got nothing to do with sex. I was extremely disappointed when we hit that. I have been hearing about it, and it didn't have nothing to do with sex, but it had everything to do with Ralph. It had everything to do with the man I was becoming. It had everything to do with who it was I was going to be. When I did sex inventory, when I first did my first one, I wrote on, and you guys, I've written on every single person that I can think of that I've had a relationship with in my life. Not talking about, now I told you guys and I've been real candid about who I am. I'm a smoker too, so I've had a lot of motel experiences. And I ain't wrote on every single one of them, but I wrote about them as a group. You know, but I've written about one night stands, I've written about wives, I've written about girlfriends, I've written about mistresses, I've written about people who were married, I've written about, you know, any and every kind of relationship that I've written about them. And I've taken a look at Ralph White. And I've done it for one reason and one reason only, to shape a sane and sound ideal for my own, not only future, but my current sex life. And that's the purpose of sex conduct inventory, to shape a sane and sound ideal for my sex life. Most of us don't have an ideal. We hit or miss it. We get into it, and then, you know, I got a friend, and he's got one standard when he goes into a relationship. I like who likes me. And a lot of us have that standard, too. I like who likes me. And I go up into it, and that's pretty much my standard. I don't have rules, and I don't have things that govern. This is what governs me. I'm a nice guy, and I'm a good guy. And I don't want to hurt nobody. And if somebody get hurt, we got a step that's going to take care of that. We got an amend step, and I'm ready, and I'm down for that. And I enter these verbal contracts with somebody. Baby, this time we just going to hit it and quit. We don't mean nothing about this. This ain't going to be serious. And that's a crazy thing. You know, the idea that two people can lay down and one person might not wake up with feelings. You know, that thing is crazy because I've been in it. I'm a grown-ass man. I've seen it happen every now. But the reason why we write those contracts is every now and then they work. The cool thing about when they work is I usually don't like it. I usually don't like it when it works. The reason it works that when one person don't wake up with feelings is she don't like my ass. I don't like that. Now, I don't want you to be stuck on me, but I don't like you to not like me. That's the, you know what I'm saying? You know, I want to be the one that don't be feeling you. But when you ain't feeling me, oh, we got a problem. You know, Houston, we got a problem. You know, not really. And so now I'm in this thing and I hook up and I get in this, and this is the way things usually operate for me. She's a fit. You know, I can work with this. You know, I'm really a guy. I ain't trying to be in no relationship. I'm not trying to get committed. I do it like this, and I know that I operate in my head. Okay, she's about an A or a B. I'm not going to go for that, especially early. I'll go for a C or a D. That way, they'll be grateful. It's no way I can get stuck on her, and they should be grateful they're with me. That's how I operate sometimes, you know. That's how I operate, and they should be stuck with me. And then I go into the dishonesty. When you say, what's the dishonesty? It's what's the worst that can happen? I might have to make amends. It never dawns on me that I might end up being the one that sprung. Ooh. And it ain't no fun when the rabbit's got the gun. And I've been in that position before, you know. And you, fellas, that never dawns on you that that's on the radar. Never dawns on me. And I think that I go in here. So that's the kind of dishonesty I operate with. And I operate with, okay, she's a fixer-upper. I can work with this. And you know, the cold thing about that kind of dishonesty is when you working with a fixer-upper and they think they working with a fixer-upper. You know, that's a cold thing. That is a cold thing. So then I start asking myself those 9 questions. Where have I been, where have I been dishonest? I was dishonest with myself. The dishonesty starts with myself. Me and you both made an agreement. But Spons, I told her, I was straight up. I was honest when I went up in here. Okay, you were honest when you went up in here that you could predict how your feelings were going to be when this thing jumped off. You were honest when you went in here that you could predict what was going to go haywire down the road. You were honest when you went in here that you could predict that there would be a baby coming down the line. Oh, I didn't see that coming. No. Then, you know, what happened, Spons? She said. Mm-hmm. And now I'm supposed to hold your feet to that verbal contract, because a verbal contract is supposed to be binding on emotional feelings. Wow. Where have I been selfish? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been inconsiderate? Did I consider your babies? Did I consider your job? Did I consider your family? Did I consider my family? Did I consider my job when we were taking off the meat at the motel? Did I consider you? Whom did I hurt? I hurt my employer. I hurt my kids. I hurt my family. Everybody. You know, so those questions, man, I write them in a narrative form, and I write them about each relationship I was in, and I started writing, and I do it with a critical eye, and I do it looking back. It's a looking back experience. You know, that experience right there, it's a looking back experience, and I answer each one of them. Where did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy? Where did I unjustifiably arouse suspicion? Where did I unjustifiably arouse bitterness? And that unjustifiably, when I first looked at that, I said, why would it say unjustifiably? When do I justifiably arouse jealousy? Well, I'm a guy that sponsors a lot of people. If you're going to be with Ralph White, you happen to know that. Where did I justifiably arouse jealousy? Well, I brought Charlie home, and we're going to do a fifth step. Lisa says, I want to watch whatever we were watching. I want you to watch River. I want you to take us. I want to watch Game of Thrones tonight, Daddy. Well, I promised I'm doing a fifth step tonight. I'm going to do a fifth step. Because when you get with Ralph White, you get with a guy that's serious about this deal right here. This deal right here. So that's not unjustifiably arousing jealousy. Sometimes when you do the deal that you do, folk are going to get bitter sometime, and folk are going to get suspicious. I did a fifth step on Christmas Eve in my office. Went home. My sponsee was calling me 2 hours later. Put his wife on the phone. Sponsee, tell her I was in your office. Tell her where I was. Was with somebody, because it took a long time before the spouse got used to him being away from home that long and not knowing where he was. Aroused suspicion, but he was doing the right thing then. And told her, still didn't the right thing. So that's why that unjustifiably arousing comes up. You know, that's a whole different thing than me bringing Charlie home. And I told, and I done already said, look, we're going to listen to a fifth step tonight, baby. Boom, boom, boom. I wanted to watch Game of Thrones. That's a whole different thing than I come home. Damn, I'm tired tonight, baby. I don't have time, you know, for us to spend time together. Then Charlie calls and says, I got Cowboys tickets. And all of a sudden, that's a, oops, I'm ready to go. Now, that is unjustifiably arousing bitterness and suspicion right there. You know, I'm too tired to spend time with you, but Charlie's got Cowboy tickets, you know. So now that's unjustifiably. And so I look at those dying questions, and I look at what should I have done and said in each one of those areas. And I shape a sane and sound ideal. And I start asking questions, and I start determining how I want to be in a relationship. Not who I'm looking for. Most of the magazines are going around, and they talk about that. 20 questions and 40 ways to hold a man, 20 ways to please a man, 20 ways to get the girl. You know, sex conduct inventory is about me looking at me. Me looking at me. What kind of man do I want to be? What kind of man do I want to be in a relationship? What are the qualities that I want to bring to the table? What are the things that I'm looking for that I want to bring? Everybody looks at relationships in one way, and they'll say, we'll be sitting at the table and we'll say, damn, what are you like? You know, I want somebody that's dependable. I want somebody that's trustworthy. I want somebody that's reliable. I want somebody that's, you know, that's got that's spiritually grounded. Ooh, I want all those things too. We are made for each other. Now, ain't neither one of us got those things. Well, we both want those things, and we think that makes us a perfect match. So I come out of the back end of that, and I shape a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life. I'm going to get out of here real fast. I'm going to touch on the fifth step. What qualifies you to listen to a fifth step? Anybody? What qualifies you to listen to a fifth? Anybody? Haven't done a fifth. Having taken a fifth. Having taken a fifth. It's real easy to sit up and say, well, you know, oh, man. And when I have guys that balk at fourth steps, I ask them, are they sponsoring? And I have a couple who are sponsoring now who have balked early. You ever see yourself sponsoring? Yeah. You believe in these 12 steps? Yeah. You ever think you're going to ask a guy to do a fourth and a fifth step? Yeah. You think you want to sit down and listen to a fifth step and you've never done a fifth step? What qualifies you to do a fifth is to hear a fifth is to have done a fifth. And now, and really quickly, when you do a fifth, when you listen to a fifth, a lot of times you do a mini fifth when you get make a person comfortable. Here's some quick things to do. I'm going to get out of here. Listening to a fifth, what you don't do. You don't sit up when you're listening to it. Ooh, shit. Oh, God damn. Don't do that. That is not what you do in a fifth step. Don't do that. More importantly, and more often what will happen is, don't snore. If you listen to enough fifth steps, you'll get one of those too. Don't snore. But the best thing to do, and the best thing that you'll find in listening to a fifth step, you will get that. When I was telling you about this guy right here, it is the most humbling and the most gratifying honor I think all of us get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I like it when you come up here and you're going to hug us and tell us. But when you listen and look in somebody's eye and they do a fifth step with you and they trust you like that. When they trust you like that, you won't be the same. It's different even than when you do a fifth. Now, when you do a fifth, you'll never be the same either. But when you hear a fifth, you know, it'll be, so those are both sides of the same coin.
I'm Charlie, I'm an alcoholic. The two most frequent lies you'll hear told from the podium, one is, I'll be brief, and the other one is, I'll end with this.
Which one, when did I say I'll end with?
You said, I'm just going to get this and I get out of here.
And then
I ain't tripping. No, I like what he said. You know, it's funny, that term tripping just it kills me because I think of Ralph. But I was in Atlanta one time and I was going to the airport and I was trying to fill the rental car up with gas before I dropped it off because they charge you about $50 a gallon for gas in a rental car. So I'm going to fill it up and I'm in a hurry and Katie's in the car and I can't get the pump to work. And I'm pissed off and I'm ready, you know, to kind of unload. And I go in there, and this guy's behind the and I go, man, what is the deal with pump number 3? And he goes, oh, man, that pump be tripping. I'm telling you, it completely disarmed me. I mean, you know, because you can't lay blame. You can't affix blame. If something just be tripping, you can't, it's nobody's fault. They just tripping, you know. So... We have plugged that in at my company now. Sometimes we just go, oh, I'd just be tripping, you know. Oh my gosh, that's good stuff, Ralph. I really enjoying this weekend and getting to see, you know, there's a couple of bullet points I was going to talk about. You know, one of the things that you talked about was how many people should be on my inventory. How many of this? How long should that? And one of my favorite ones I've seen lately was this guy asking his sponsor. He says, "How long do I have to work these steps?" And his sponsor says, "Until you die from something else." You know, that's pretty good. Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. You know, there are different things like that thing where you're talking about. Do I put myself on my resentment inventory? I don't do it. You know, and one of my sponsors said one of the most because. The thing I worry about is if my problem is selfishness and self-centeredness, who's the first person I want to talk about my inventory? You know, me. And then when we get to the amends process, who should I make amends to first? How about me? You know, and so this one of my sponsors had a guy that said, do I put myself in the first column on the inventory? And Phil said the smartest thing. He goes, you know what? We're going to leave you out of the first column, but you get the whole fourth column. You know, that's, you're all we're going to talk about in the fourth column. You know, so, but you know, before we get back into the mechanics of this, and I'm a technician. I really like the process of this and the results that it brings. And one of the things that I'll talk about as a wonderful example, Gary Brown sponsored Don Pritz, and he's like way up in my lineage of sponsorship. And one time, and Gary's 54 years sober now, and the way that started was in Denver, there was a guy named Mac Cheater that came from Canada and came down and talked in Denver, and he was a big book guy. He was a step worker. He was, you know, and... So after he left, Gary and 14, there was 14 people that got together and said, why don't we do an exercise? And what we're going to do is we're going to sit down together as a group and we're going to go through this book just like what Ralph was talking about. When we come to an action, we're going to take it. When it comes to a statement, we're going to turn it into a question. When it comes to a prayer, we're going to pray it. And they went through the whole book just like that. And here it is 50 years later. And of those 14 people, one died in a snowstorm, one relapsed and went out and died in the cold, and the other 13 are either still sober or died sober. You know, and it's the power of a technical approach to this process. You know, so I don't get all, you know, I mean, it's funny, I hear people go, well, in meetings, people always want to apologize for coming out of the book. They want to go, I'm no big book quoter or anything. And you're like, oh, no, we don't do that, for God's sakes, you know. We'd much rather hear your opinion, you know. Maybe we could talk about your divorce for another minute, you know. But you know, why do I want to do this inventory thing? What's the use of this whole inventory? Is it a worthwhile spiritual exercise or not? You know, or is it just something the people in AA do, and if you're going to be in the club, you have to do it? Because there's a big difference between, in the absence of this process, and I don't think our founders ever foresaw a time when a drunk of any description would be able to stay sober just by going to AA meetings. Back then, they worked the program, and they had the meetings, and they talked about the results of the program, or they talked about how they're going to carry this program to other people. But I don't think they ever foresaw a time that people would be staying sober just by going to meetings. You know, and I hate to say it, but I think somebody that has worked all 12 steps is by far in the minority in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you were to survey the fellowship on a broad scale, I think people that have really done the whole deal are probably in the minority in the rooms of AA, especially people that have made all their amends and sponsoring people and living in the disciplines of 10 and 11. I just don't think they ever saw that coming. But what happens in that type of AA program is I have a rough day. I go to the 5:30 meeting, and we're talking about fear. And we're talking about fear, and I got fear. I can share on fear, you know. And then Lindsay talks about her fear, you know. And then Tarek raises his hand, and he talks about his fear. Ralph talks, and I start seeing other people got fear. I'm not the only one with fear. And I get a little relief, and I get a little comfort from that. And so what happens is I get a little relief, and I go back out in the world, and by 5:30 tomorrow, by God, I need another meeting, you know. And because I'm going to the meetings, and I'm getting relief, but I'm not getting the freedom that's available as a result of this process. And where does the freedom come in this resentment inventory? Because, and I like that we're not talking, because I can spend a lot of time talking about a technical approach about how to do a resentment inventory and a fear inventory, and I could talk for 4 hours about it easily. But everybody in this room has done inventory before, and it is funny because my first sponsor was a one inventory guy. He said, you only ever do one inventory. If you do more than one inventory, you're just bragging, stuff like that. And while it's true, like Ralph said, if you do the four-step inventory, and then you carry that into 6 and 7, you go out and make all your amends that have come out of that, and then you do evening review every night, you do a 10th step through the day, you take that in the evening review that night, and you carry those considerations into your morning meditation, you could live the rest of your life without ever having to do another major four-column inventory. And if you do that, we'll build a statue in your honor and in front of the General Service Office, because most of us could talk about somebody that bugs us a little bit. You know, I start putting different names on it, you know. I mean, like, it's not really a resentment. They just kind of bug me a little bit, you know. You're like, well, let's do a bugs me inventory, you know. But where does the freedom come in this process? Because there's no real freedom in writing down who I'm mad at, what they did, and how it affected me. I mean, there's some awareness that comes out of that, and awareness is a great motivator for change, but where does the freedom come? And it comes, you know, and there's a whole bunch of people that think there's only three columns in the not so much in this room. But I've had 25-year members of AA come up to me, and this sweet guy in Fort Smith, Arkansas came up one time, and he goes, can you show me this fourth column that you're talking about? And I said, yes, I can. It's real easy to miss, you know. It's right. And I don't care whether you call it the fourth column, the fifth column, the expanded fifth column, the sixth, you know, whatever it is. There's a body of work on page 67 and 60 that is a huge piece of the freedom that comes. And I have, this has become much more important to me in the last 10 years of my sobriety. So this is stuff that I've really learned to work with further on down the road and further in experience and sponsoring a bunch of guys and hearing a bunch of inventory. Now, nobody hears inventory better than my wife. I'll say that in front of anybody I've ever met. She's the best at hearing inventory of anybody I've ever seen. I mean, she goes deeper, faster. Even one of my best sponsors, he said, God dang, when you do inventory with Katie, she just digs and digs and digs, and you go, wow, thanks, Katie. I never saw it like this. She goes, oh, no, no, we're still digging, you know. And it goes a lot deeper. And it's funny, one time I even did an exercise at the table. Well, I said, okay, boys, here's my resentment. Here's what I got. Here's what's on my inventory right now. I go, where do y'all go with it? And all the boys at the table, we sat there, and just like we've been doing the last 2 weeks, talking about where would you go with this inventory. And in that week, I did the inventory with one of Katie's sponsees, and I came back the next Thursday, and I said, okay, boys, here's where she went with it. And they were all like, dang. We went about that deep, you know? And so where do you get freedom in this stuff? And there was a piece I didn't work with. If I was going to do that thing where I said you draw a line down the middle of this page, a line down the middle of this page, I actually put a second line down the middle of this page, so there's a little bitty column in the middle of that page. And it's funny that you said sick man prayer, because the first time I ever heard that, Katie was sponsoring this woman, and she's just coming back into AA, but she was been gone a long time. And she told me, I met this guy at work, and I did that sick man prayer on him. And it was the first time we'd ever heard it. We started calling it the sick man prayer, and it's kind of caught on. But whether you call it the compassion exercise, the sick man prayer, there's a body of work here that changes everything in the inventory. And it's cleverly wedged between the third column and the fourth column. And it's down here at the bottom of page 66 where it says, we turned back to the list where it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. And right there in my book, I've written, are you? Because when I'm sitting there hearing inventory with a guy, I'll go, Will, are you prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle? And I'll wait for them to go, yeah, I am. Because, all right, here we go. And it says, we began to see that the world and its We're going to look at it from a different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. Now, when you think about that, that means the only thing that's really dominating me, it's not that big, really. It's just the world and its people, you know. Other than that, I'm pretty chill, you know. The only thing that annoys me is just the world and its people, you know. And it says, in that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had the power to kill. How could we escape? Here's what we were talking about before breakfast this morning, is that here's another place where it's going to bring me to a spot where it's going to say, here's the problem. Do you admit that it's objectionable? Oh, and by the way, you can't do a damn thing about it yourself. It says, how could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We couldn't wish them away any more than alcohol. This is our founders tell us we couldn't make them, just like selfishness. I wish I could just hear a talk and go, you know, I'm just going to be less selfish. You know, that guy, he was right. I'm going to start thinking about others, and I'm going to start working at the soup kitchen. You know, I'm probably going to study the Bible, or I don't know. You know, but I mean, I'm going to be less selfish. But it ain't happening. You know, I can't pull it off out there where the rubber meets the road. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. I do it. Now, Katie does a lot of her work in expanded third column. I do most of my work in this sick man exercise and the fourth column. And it says, the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're a lot sicker than I am. But what if we're just two people walking the same path? Because remember how I said earlier that I judge all my actions by my motives and this delusion. If everybody just done right, it would have been fine. But I don't do that. If you screw up, it's an outrage and I demand justice. I don't run your actions through that funnel. So, like, because if I hurt your feelings, I want to talk about what I was trying to do. I didn't mean to do that. If you want to see a foul up as a result of good motives, just go to your AA meeting when nobody's there and rearrange the furniture while everybody's gone. You know, watch what happens when they come in. You know, they will. You can't buy a new coffee pot in an AA club without people losing their minds. You know, and you're like, going, but I was just trying to bring more light into the room. You know, I wasn't trying to. You know, and people go, and so I always want to talk about what my motives were, and that's not what the people that are on want to talk about. But the problem is when you foul up, I don't think about what's driving you or what your background was or what your motives you had or what you're trying to do or who you are or where you came from. It's just an outrage, and you should pay. You know, so we do this compassion exercise, and I've been telling this story for a while, but it's one of the best examples I've ever seen of it. Because I love this piece in the fourth column, and I was sponsoring this guy named Roy, and he's told me it was okay to tell this story. And I've been telling it for years. But Roy had his dad on his fourth step, and for second column, what happened? He says, one day I was sitting out on the front porch, I was about 12, and my dad gets out of his car and he comes walking in the house, and when he walks by me, he says, your mom killed herself today. And he walks on into the house, and, you know, and it's like, how could anybody be that heartless, that cold? And everybody's like, oh, you know, poor Roy, and that's what. And boy, you could get a lot of that kind of advice in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You poor thing, you should have never gone through that. But I'm like, that ain't where we're going, you know. And so that, what we started doing, you remember when I said we're on a fact-finding and a fact-facing mission? Now, the way I don't fall asleep here in inventories now is I'm talking almost as much as they are. I feel like a news reporter sometimes, you know. I'm asking questions and I'm getting information. And next thing you know, you'll hear yourself intuitively saying something you've never said to anybody before. You ever say something where you go, dang, that was strong. I need to write that down, you know. I mean, you know, but you know, I said, with Roy, I started asking him questions. I started getting some information. I go, now let me ask you a few questions. I go, so you said you were 12. How many kids were in your family? He says, three. And I said, how far apart were they? He's 2 years apart. And I said, where'd you fall in those three kids? He says, I was in the middle. I go, and where were you living? He says, we were living in this little town in Texas. And I said, so how was the money situation? And he goes, well, I mean, it was okay. He goes, we weren't like over it or anything, but my dad was a welder. We were doing okay, you know. And I go, now, and your parents were still together? And he says, yeah. And I go, now, I'm guessing there'd been a lot of drama and trauma and stuff with your mom over the years. And he goes, oh, yeah, my mom had a lot of emotional disturbance and stuff like that. Anyway, and so your dad has been, now I'm guessing if you're 12 and your brother's 14, I'm going to put your dad in his late 30s. And he goes, yeah, that's probably about right. He's probably 37, 38. And I go, so did we ever think about how he grew up or what kind of background he had and what amount of dealings did he have? Is it, you know, and so I'm looking at a guy now that's a 38-year-old welder in this little town in Texas. And his wife has had a long history of mental illness, and he's got three kids there, and at least one of them's a budding self-centered alcoholic. But he's had all this trouble with his wife, and she's had, you know, a lot of trauma in the past, but on this day she has killed herself. Now he's got to leave his job. He's got to come home. He's got to notify everybody in this little town he lives in that his wife has committed suicide. He's got to notify all his relatives and all of her relatives that his wife has committed suicide. He's got to get the judgment of all these people. And looking at that, given his background and the amount of dealings he had from the way he grew up, is it possible that when he walked by you and said, your mom killed herself today, that was just the, given what he had going on that day, is it possible that was just the best he could do at that time? And Roy said, my favorite thing to hear in the fourth column of an inventory, he goes, oh my God. Remember, we're talking about manifestations of self here. And he goes, oh my God. I never thought about my dad for a second. I've been waiting 40 years for my dad to come apologize to me. I need to go find my dad tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Mark used to say the fourth column turns the second column into a lie. And when he said that, I'm like, what are you even talking about? You know, I saw the second column. I wouldn't be writing it down if it didn't happen. And here was a case where I watched a 40-year-old resentment just go, just like that. And all of a sudden he's going, I'm looking at it completely differently now. Luke was talking about it Friday night. He said, I'm in the entirely different angle business now. That's what I'm doing when I'm here in inventory. When you're calling me with a 10th step, I'm sitting there searching and thinking, what's an entirely different angle? What's another way of looking at this? How did they set the ball rolling? How did they make decisions based on self that started them down this road? How are they looking at it delusionally? You know, because one time I asked Mark, I said, why does it talks about dishonesty in the evening review. Was I dishonest? No. Was I dishonest? No. Next day, no. Next day, no. And I go, it started making me nervous because I'm thinking if it wasn't ever going to come up for me, they probably wouldn't have put it in there. And Mark goes, well, there's three forms of dishonesty. There's lying to people, and that's the one I wasn't doing, right? I wasn't just straight up lying. And then he goes, then there's lying by omission. I went, uh-oh, hold on a minute, because it's not my fault if I shape the story and you just get a little different impression from what I'm saying, you know, and you can be real good at that, you know. Like, you know, just a real simple example is like I'm late, and you go, there was a wreck on the highway. And there was. It didn't have a damn thing to do with why I was late. But you can go on and think whatever you want to think, you know. And then the last form of dishonesty was delusion. And delusion's where I'm lying to myself. Oh, my God, did that blow open the delusion, the dishonesty column for me? One time I was doing inventory on a sponsee. When you're talking about having people, I've got one sponsee that I've written inventory on at least three times. And I was doing inventory on this new guy one time, and then, oh my God, he was about to drive me up the wall. And so in the second column, well, he's self-centered. He talks all the time. He doesn't listen. He doesn't. When I'm talking, he's not paying attention to me. He's thinking about what he's going to say. He makes commitments to do work, and then he doesn't do it. We make an appointment to do inventory, and he cancels at the last minute. I've set aside 4 hours of my day. You know, and he calls 5 minutes before and says, oh, I can't come, you know, and or he doesn't call at all. And I'm running down all this stuff. And when I get up, how does it affect me? My ambitions. I want to be a good sponsor. I want to be. And then when we get over into this thing and I start looking at who he really is, and then I get to the fourth column, I go, under dishonesty, I go, Charlie, is it possible that it's delusional to think that this new guy is not going to act like a new guy? You know? I mean, what you put in the second column is the description of an untreated newcomer in here. So who's the old timer here? Who's the one that's, you know, who's the one in recovery here? I'm acting like this guy should have a spiritual awakening before he's gone through the process, you know? And I see it over and over and over again, you know? And so my favorite thing to hear when we do these, that fourth column is to hear a guy go, oh my God, you know, because I've done it. I had one guy where we did it with his dad, and then we did it with his mom, and then we went to his ex-girlfriend. He's like, oh, geez. You know, and every one of them is getting pounded in that fourth column. We see, you know, like he had one. I had a guy the other day, this is one of my favorite sponsees. He's about 27 years sober, and his whole life, his dad has been in his inventory, and in the second column, my dad was never there. 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 You know, and how did it affect me? He was just never there. And so the other day, and this guy, the other day, three of his high school buddies, guys he grew up all the way from elementary school with, went to play golf, and they're sitting in the clubhouse after the round of golf. Now, two of these guys aren't in recovery, but when they're sitting there, and this one guy goes, you know, Rick, they're talking about their brains. He goes, you know what I remember about your dad? And he goes, no, what? And he goes, your dad was at everything. And he goes, what? And he goes, I mean it. He goes, my dad was working all the time. He goes, your dad was at everything. He was at every practice. He was at every game. He went on the road trips with him. He went on the field trips with him. I remember being jealous because your dad was at everything. And Rick goes, what? And he's sitting there going, well, seems like I looked for him one time and he wasn't there, you know. I mean, and so that's what came up with this one guy. I go, you say your dad was never there. Is it possible that he had this budding alcoholic you know, as soon as he come home from work, he's got this black hole of emotional need jumping on him. You know, is it possible he just wasn't there enough for that? You know, and he goes, oh my, you know. And then we did his girlfriend, and he sees it again, and he goes, you know, Charlie, I'm really a pretty good guy. You know, I'm like, I ain't mad at you, but he's like, I'm showing up like a real asshole in this fourth column, but people like me, you know, I'm really, you know, I'm like, I feel you, I understand completely. But, you know, just to close out, well, we got a few more minutes. This one may run about 10 minutes long. What this does, look at what it says now. After I've looked at this person and what's driving them, it says, though we didn't like their symptoms, which is what they did to me in column two, or the way they disturbed me, which is the stuff in column three, they, like me, were sick too. And now it goes on to say, we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, patience, and pity that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And on January of 2014, I had an enormous experience with that sentence right there. Because we talk about this sick man prayer, and it talks about we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, compassion, and patience that we would grant a sick friend. And I was reading that inventory to Katie Sponsee that I was talking about earlier, and when we were talking about it, it was the one about the work never stops. The whole theme of that inventory was the work never stops. And what I realized was in this inventory, this isn't the piece I was going to talk about just now, but the reason we call it The Work Never Stopped was because it was very important for you to agree with me, and for you to agree with me, and for Lindsay to agree with me, and for Ralph to agree with me. So if you didn't agree with me, I had to come over and I had to concentrate on you. And when I get you to see it my way, then I issue you a Charlie team jersey, and now you're on the team, but there's a million more people to go, and the work never stops. I'm constantly trying to get people to see it my way, and I can't stand it if they don't. That was the whole theme of that inventory. But what we came up with my family, this is when I had to start shifting that story about my sister would give a woodpecker a headache. And I said that for a long time. I still say it. But my sister's out in California one time, and she worked in the school system. There was this lady there working there, and she goes, and these CDs get around. You know, these CDs travel. This woman says she's in AA. And my sister goes, oh, my brother's in AA. And they start talking, you know, and they're talking about AA. And they say, I don't know how she says my name. And this woman goes, wait a minute. My sister's telling me a story. She goes, are you telling me your brother's Charlie P. from Austin, Texas? And she goes, yeah. And when she's telling me, I was horrified because I thought she was about to say, the woman's going to go, you're the one that would give a woodpecker a headache, you know? And I was like, I got to stop saying that, you know? I got to start saying that, because really the truth was that I was intolerant of my sister and the family stuff. And so back to this thing about we ask God this prayer, we ask God, I said it to this woman, and she goes, tell me about that word show. And I said, well, I mean, we ask God to help us show them tolerance and compassion. And she goes, what does that mean? And I go, well, I mean, she goes, I see that word show as a call to action. And I never thought about it before, but the Oxford movement used to talk about demonstrate. That was a common term. And the Oxford, you got your demonstration, you demonstrate this. And when we change that word show to demonstrate, what I realized is that I had been asking God to help me feel tolerance and compassion and patience. And I don't know about you guys, but the family environment can be one of my shortest triggered situations. I'm liable to go off, you know, because like one time we're at the family deal at my mother's house. I'm a big boy. My clothes need to be big, you know, and I don't need, so when I put them in the dryer, I just warm them up and hang them up. That's it. In fact, I might even put a little stretch on them, you know. Well, one day I put some laundry in at my mother's house, and my sister puts them in and just cooks them in the dryer, and I pull out my little shirt, you know, and now here comes the maniac, you know, the guy with 30 years of sobriety and God and the 12 steps in his life, you know. That's the example I use, because I prayed before that encounter, but what I realized I'd been doing was I asked God to help me feel tolerance and compassion and patience. But as soon as something happened where I didn't feel it anymore, all bets are off. But what we're doing here is we're asking God to give us the strength to demonstrate tolerance and compassion and patience, whether I feel it or not. So now we're not being driven by our feelings as much as trying to live by spiritual principles. Because if I'm living by my feelings, I'm batted around like a leaf in the wind. You know, so it really made a big change in this thing. And it says, when a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick person. How can I be helpful? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. Does that sound like the deal we made in the third step? Right here in the border of my book, it says restates step three. Right here. We avoid retaliation or argument. Why? We wouldn't treat sick people that way. But if we do retaliate or argument or argue, we destroy our chance of being helpful. You know, if there's some guy coming out of the side of his neck in my home group, if I yell at him across the meeting or tell him he's an idiot, you know, when he does get in trouble, I'm not the guy he's going to come to for help. You know, it says if we retaliate or argue, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We can't be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Now, that's the end of that little sick man exercise or the compassion exercise. But notice how it's wedged right between the third column and the fourth column, where now all of a sudden that moves me into that. When we talk about that resentment going like that, now I can look at it and go, oh, my God, I really am that selfish. But I have zero, none of my, you know, all my childhood memories are of me. I don't have any memories of what was going on with my parents or anything like that. Everything I have is so self-centered. And sometimes when I, you know, and what's funny is a lot of people go into this process and into the amends process and act like the big theme is forgiveness. I think the theme is awareness, because the more awareness I have, the less forgiveness I'm needing to hand out. You know, because if you'd have asked Roy, he would have told you he needed to learn how to forgive his dad. But as a result of this exercise, he's like going, oh, dang, forgiveness is not the number one topic anymore. You know, and it really is a game changer, and I do it all the time, you know, and so that's why we've been doing this exercise at the table the last few weeks. Because not only getting everybody used to writing inventory, but getting everybody used to hearing inventory. You got 14 guys sitting there going over some, you know, if Tarek brings a resentment, you know, we all have spiritual consent with each other. So we're sitting there, you know, how would you hear this resentment? What would you say? Where would you go with it? And that sort of thing. And you learn. Now, you know, don't wait, though, till you can do this stuff perfectly, because it's my firm belief that if the sponsor and the sponsee are both giving it their best shot, God will take up a lot of slack in that equation, you know. And you know, then we get into looking at my mistakes. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking? And see how that opens up that fourth column now, where I'm looking at it from a different angle. And so that's about all I want to say on that. I could talk for a lot, but the fear inventory, remember we were talking about manifestations of self? It tells me to list my fears and ask myself why I had them, and then it gives me the answer. It said, wasn't it because self-reliance failed me? You've turned that around. Self-reliance is reliance on self. And there are things in my life that I can't handle on self-reliance. And anything that falls outside of that arena scares the crap out of me. You know, I know at some level that I can't control stroke or heart attack or cancer or some of the, you know, divorce, the way my kids are going to turn out, whether or not people are going to talk about me at the AA club, how my finances are going to turn out. There's a lot of that stuff that's outside my area of control. And when the entire basis of my life is I'm running this thing, that stuff scares me, because I know at some level I can't control how those things go. And if I can't control it, it scares me. You know, so running up against the collapse of self-will is really tough. That sex inventory, I had a guy one time that was doing sex. This guy got laid more than the Dallas Cowboys. I mean, he was a president of this social thing. He was built like he's carved out of wood, and he's given me his whole inventory, and the whole inventory was being a jerk. He was using a different word that was nickname for Richard, but he's like, you know, the girl downstairs, I was a jerk to her, and then Cindy, I was a jerk to her, and then this girl at the party, I was a jerk to her, and the whole exercise was him talking about, I was a jerk to this one, I was a jerk to this one, I was a jerk, and I heard myself saying, how could we, moving forward, how could we not be a jerk? And I didn't realize it, but that's really the drive of this exercise. It says, in this way, we try to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. And some of the way we try to shape it is by seeing what hadn't worked well in the past. You know, and it could be a moving target, but it's funny. You know, you hear some of these rules in AA. Like one of them is they say, don't get into a relationship for the first year. And you know, when you start having children, you hear yourself saying things that your parents said, and you realize, and one of the things, one time, Sadie, my youngest child, we were sitting out by the pool, and we'd been swimming, we're all playing and everything, and then we're going to have lunch. And as soon as we finish eating, she runs up to me, she goes, Daddy, I want to go back in the pool. And I go, oh, honey, you can't go back in the pool for 45 minutes after you eat, you'll get a cramp. And I hear myself saying it, and I start thinking, I go, wait a minute. I don't know anybody that knows anybody that knows anybody that's ever had a cramp, you know? And I realize that that's just something we say because as the parent, I don't want to jack with you having to be in the pool. I just ate and I want to chill for a little while. So I tell you, you can't swim for 45 minutes after you. I think it's the same reason we tell sponsees don't get into a relationship for the first year. It's like, we don't know if it really works because nobody's ever done it. But I know at some level that if you get into a relationship, my job just got a lot harder. So it's a lot easier just to go, you really shouldn't get in a relationship for the first year because I ain't trying to hear it, you know. But it says whatever our deal is. You know, and the last thing I want to say, and we're running a little bit long, but there was something going on in my sobriety that sets me apart from any other man in recovery, and certainly all the men in this room, and it was a problem with pornography. I know I'm the only one, and please don't judge me, but there was a period, you know, and they say an addiction is something you can't choose not to do, and I found myself in a place where I couldn't choose not to do it, and it was causing trouble in relationship, and it was causing trouble, and plus there was just a creep factor that emits from you that turns out women can feel it, you know, even if you're behind them, you know, they can like, ooh, you know, oh, there he is. Yeah, you know, and so I went to Mark Houston and I said, brother, I got a problem with the computer. I can't, you know, there's a time of the day, and it was kind of like heroin. You know, I always wanted to get clean and sober right after I'd done about $80 worth of heroin, and it was the same way with that. It's like, you know, man, I really need to stop doing that, you know, until it's on you, and then it's like, I don't want to hear about it, you know, and then it was, so you get in this different terrible cycle, and Mark had me do this, the sex prayer here, on page 70, and I actually wrote it down on a 3x5 business card and carried it around and had it on the dashboard of my truck, and it says, to sum up about sex, now I've already admitted this thing is objectionable and I don't have the power to change it, and we're going to talk about that in 6 and 7. It says, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, and that was the first line on that card. We pray for the right ideal for our future sex life. And then it says, for sanity, for strength, for guidance in each questionable situation, and for the strength to do the right thing. And I've worked with this with so many people, because the thing is, I always tell guys, when it comes to this sex stuff, you got to nip it way upstream, you know, because as guys, a lot of times, we like to dance right up to the edge of the fire, and I want to go like, God, if you don't, you know, like if I'm, you know, with the secretary at work, and you want to go, God, if you don't want this to happen, don't let this key work in this motel room door, you know, and, you know. I mean, by then the horse is out of the barn. You know, it's like if it's part of my sane and sound ideal, we got to nip it way upstream with that first "Hey, how you doing?" look, or that first flirtatious encounter, or that first thing. It's like, oh no, you know, have I told you about Katie? You know, and you know, and that, you know, sort of thing. Because that's the only way. One of the best examples I was, one time I was reading a thing and it said Billy Graham wouldn't have lunch with a woman by themselves or have a woman in his office without somebody else in there. I'm like, if Billy Graham's flesh is weak, what shot do I have? You know, so it's like this sane and sound ideal is, it can be a moving target, but if you find yourself in a position where stuff is happening that you had said you hope never happen again, those four things on that sex prayer have a lot of power to them, and they work as a daily exercise of saying it over and over and over until it becomes true. And you know, that's the end of four, and we'll probably touch a little bit on five when we get into six and seven on the next break. But I'm starting that one, so I can promise you I will. But the last thing I want to say about inventory is just do it. You know, I mean, yeah, I can't tell you how many times I'll meet with guys that are big book technicians, and they have been mad enough to want to get a divorce, or they've been mad enough to fire their sponsor, and you go, what just came out in inventory on that? And they're like, well, I didn't write inventory on it. You're like, so you got mad enough to fire your sponsor, but it didn't occur to you, knowing what you know about this program, to write a four-column inventory on it. That's how I fall asleep. That's how I drift away from this deal, and that's how I get blocked way down the road. So we're going to take a break. I appreciate y'all listening to us. Thanks, guys.
I think Mac at 7:00.
What happens now? It's
5:30, so it's dinner time.